Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I have with me James Turner, Kavanaugh Professor of Humanities Emeritus at Notre Dame University. We will be discussing his book, Philology, The Forgotten Origins of the Modern Humanities, published by Princeton University Press. Philology, the study of language, was for centuries synonymous with humanistic intellectual life. Turner provides a detailed and fascinating study that traces philology's beginning in Greek and Roman speculation about language and follows it to the early 20th century. At the Library of Alexandria, Greeks speculated about language, invented rhetoric, analyzed texts, and created grammar. Roman diffusion and Christian adaptation spread the influence of philology. The medieval scholars kept it alive until the Renaissance, when humanists gave it a new life only to escape the most toxic aspects of the Reformation. By the 19th century, philology covered three distinct modes of inquiry. Textual philology included the study of ancient and biblical literature, language theories of origin, and comparative historical studies of structure and language systems. All philologists held to the belief that history was key to understanding the diversity and change in language. Comparative methods and genealogical understanding accompanied historical analysis. These methods applied not only to texts, but also to material objects, structures, art, people groups, and eventually became the foundation for the modern disciplines of anthropology, history, art history, linguistics, literary and religious studies we know today. Turner points to the need to reintegrate scholarly erudition away from insular disciplines and recover the expansive and humanistic reach of philology. Here's my conversation with James Turner. Now, let me introduce you to the author, James Turner. Jim, thank you for coming to the show.
Very glad to be here.
And thank you for engaging with me on this conversation. Your book covers a lot of ground, centuries actually, and it appears to be a call to reintegrate the humanities from its disciplinary straitjacket. But before we talk about the implications of your book, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write philology.
Okay. There's a deep backstory, which I think might help potential readers of the book to understand better how I came to write it. When I was in college, I always expected to be a lawyer, to go back to Texas where I grew up, to go into politics. But in my senior year, I found myself getting kind of more and more interested in history, and I wrote a senior honors thesis. And that experience of research and writing really changed my course. And so I went to graduate school instead of going to law school. I went to graduate school intending to study Southern political history for no better reason than that my undergraduate honors thesis was on politics in late 19th century Texas. But when I got to graduate school, my first year, I realized that I really had a different motive. I really had gone to graduate school because I didn't want to give up a life devoted to books and ideas and learning new stuff. And so I decided to become an intellectual historian because I thought, rightly or wrongly, that that was an area where you could do pretty much anything you wanted to. You could focus on ideas in any time or place. And so I shifted to intellectual history. But I think because of that particular motive for doing intellectual history, I have always written books that kind of range pretty widely, pretty far back, and kind of range over a number of different topics. And so what's happened in my career is that in writing one book, I would find myself getting grabbed by something else, and that would be the next book. I wrote in the late 80s and 90s a biography of a guy called Charles Eliot Norton, who was, and he was many things, that's why I got interested in him, but he was, among other things, the major progenitor of the humanities as new disciplines in American universities in the later 19th century. And I came to realize in writing about that part of his career that he approached the history of art, English poetry, archaeology, a whole variety of topics that he worked on and wrote about, thinking like a textual philologist. That is to say, he would approach the objects of his study, whether that was medieval church building or ancient Greek temples, as if those objects were texts. And to understand them, you had to put them in their historical context. And to then see why they were important, why they mattered now, you had to shift back and forth between that historical context and the and their meanings for the people who made them and their potential meanings for us. Because Norton worked as a philologist, I got interested in philology, in trying to understand philology and that and its connection to the humanities as those exist in modern higher education. And so that ultimately dragged me into this book. And I just said, okay, I want to find out about philology. I want to learn some new stuff. And so I kept moving further and further back in time to try to understand it. And so I found myself really beginning with the ancient Greek world and varieties of learning in what we now call humanistic scholarship then.
So what is philology?
That's a very good question. Today, philology is understood almost entirely as the study of texts, particularly ancient texts. So you have classical philologists who try to understand and correct the texts that descend to us from ancient Greece and Rome. You have biblical philologists who try to understand and make more accurate the texts that comprise the Bible. But in the 19th century, when philology gave birth to the modern humanities, as I eventually came to understand, philology had a much broader significance. It was all studies of language as a phenomenon, apart from specific languages, but just trying to understand what language is, the study of specific languages and language families, such as the Indo-European family, which a lot of attention was concentrated in the 19th century, and textual philology, the studies of text, not just ancient text, but medieval, early modern, and modern text. So that's philology.
Well, let's go back. What did the Greeks and Romans think they were doing? What was philology for them?
Yeah.
Let's start from the very beginning and kind of work our way through.
Yeah. They were trying to understand text, and this has a lot to do with the fact that books are invented in the Western world, at least, in ancient Greece and then adopted by ancient Rome. So they've got all these manuscripts of books, Homer the most important for the ancient Greeks especially, and they've because of the multiplication of manuscripts, all, of course, done by copying by hand, lots of mistakes get introduced into those manuscripts. So the first task of ancient Greeks and Romans was to sort out the text and try to figure what was the correct form of the text.
So this is a very technical exercise. This is not an interpretive exercise at this point.
It starts as a very technical exercise. It quickly leads into interpretation because you're not only, once you've corrected the text, once you think you've got what the author originally wrote, then you've got to try to understand the text. That, in turn, leads into a historical dimension. You've got to understand the culture, as we would now say, that produced the text in order to understand the text. But put simply, you know, if you want to understand Homer, well, you need to understand something about the archaic Greek world that Homer's text came from. And that, in turn, generates among these ancient scholars a fascination with the past in all of its aspects. And so they're probing into the past in a variety of ways.
So what was their idea about language? They have a very different concept of language they were curious about it.
They were very curious about it. And the process of understanding language goes along with the process of trying to understand the text written in those languages. And so it was the ancient Greeks, in the ancient Hellenistic world, two or three centuries before the birth of Christ, it was in that world that grammar was invented as a way of trying to understand language. Because you got to understand language if you're going to do the same with the text written in. So you've got grammar, you've got rhetoric, which is the most important part of education, did not play a huge role in scholarship in those days, but it was connected with textual studies, with the study of language as a phenomenon.
What about the connection to politics?
In
rhetoric, persuasion.
In the study of rhetoric, that emerges really because of politics. It first appears in ancient Greece, and especially in Athens, at the time when the Athenians are moving to a kind of political order that can loosely be called democratic, as long as you understand that women and slaves and so forth are all excluded from this. But citizens have to make the decisions. And if you want something to happen, if you want somebody to be convicted of a crime like Socrates, or if you want a particular decision to be made about going to war or not going to war, you have to persuade your fellow citizens. And that's the origins of rhetoric, really. If you look at ancient Rome, which picks up rhetoric from ancient Greece, the ancient Greek world, you see the same phenomenon. It's very closely connected with the political order. You have someone like Cicero, who writes a treatise on rhetoric while also being, perhaps the greatest orator of the ancient Roman world.
Now, you also introduce into this Greek, Roman, you bring in Jewish and Christian contributions to philology.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect the reading of their sacred texts?
Mm-hmm. The ancient rabbis, who are the first ones really to study the Bible as a text that needs to be understood, possibly corrected, interpreted, they bring to that project many of the same skills that the Greeks of the ancient Hellenistic world had pioneered. That's a natural move because, after all, they come from the same part of the world. You know, they come from the Eastern Mediterranean. Ancient Christian scholars also very self-consciously sometimes borrow the techniques of ancient Roman scholars to understand their emerging New Testament, as well as to understand the Hebrew Bible, which of course they come to call the Old Testament, and they know it primarily in its Greek translation, the Septuagint. So you transfer into what was emerging as Christendom, that is to say, the Christianized Roman Empire, both Eastern and Western. You transfer into that Christian intellectual heritage and the by then suppressed and marginalized Jewish intellectual heritage, you transfer into that those skills perfected by the ancient Hellenistic world and the ancient Roman world. And so philological studies, linguistic studies, become an important part of the Christian heritage that sort of shapes our world and we inherit.
Now we get into the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. the Renaissance, and the Reformation, mm-hmm. and how philology really survived mm-hmm. those three mm-hmm. different aspects. First, in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. how the monks kept it alive. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, philology, in a sense, fell on hard times in the Middle Ages. It certainly did survive. There were, especially in the earlier Middle Ages, up to the 12th century, say, a fair number of scholars, most of them monks or clerics, who were actually interested in the study of text in the same way that the ancient Greeks and Romans had been, though they were often paying attention to different texts, especially the Bible. But in the High Middle Ages, the very kind of empirical, concrete study of text gave way to an interest in philosophy, in more abstract ideas. The study of text sort of fell into abeyance in the High Middle Ages.
In your book, you make a very clear point that philosophy is a different branch of knowledge.
Yes, which is not to say that it had no influence. There was no
cross-pollination.
Cross-pollination, exactly, a good term. But that it was a very different in approach. And philosophers often, not always, but often looked down on philology as a kind of second-rate form of knowledge.
Okay, so you've got the... What happens in the Renaissance?
What happens is that first in northern Italy, and then on the other side of the Alps, learned individuals become more and more interested, again, in the ancient Roman heritage at first, and then the ancient Greek heritage. And so they're going back to what they saw as a, again, to use a modern term, a culture that was intellectually superior to the Middle Ages. And they want to recover that ancient world.
So is this sort of the story of decline all over all over again? The idea that everybody thinks that what was before them was always better than what they have today?
Well, not what was before them, because...
But it was way before them,
because they looked down on the Middle Ages. They invented the term the Middle Ages precisely in order to define a period of decline between the late Roman Empire and their own times. And it was a pejorative term at first. But in order to recover that ancient world, they had to, in their own minds, recover the language spoken then, which at first means classical Latin. In trying to recover that language, they, of course, have to recover the texts that survive in that language. They devote themselves to searching out ancient texts and then to correcting them, amending them, so they can find out of these five copies of a particular oration of Cicero, which one of them is closest to what Cicero actually said. And so you're back to textual study. You're back to linguistic study, because they're trying to speak and write the same Latin that was spoken and written in the classical world. One of the things they discover is that there is no single form of classical Latin. The Latin that Cicero wrote, for example, is quite different in some ways from the Latin that Tacitus wrote.
So this, before the printing press, it was very difficult to keep text clean. Mm-hmm. From copy to copy, because mm-hmm. you're doing it, it's all being done manually. Mm-hmm. Now, what time period are we talking about here, the High Middle Ages? We're talking about the 13th century?
13th, 14th century.
Okay, is this not the time when, is the West discovering Eastern texts? Sanskrit and...
That comes a little bit later.
Okay.
Because in the 13th and 14th century, Europe is still, or what we now call Europe, is still... relatively weak compared to the great Asian civilizations, especially China. It's only in the early modern period when Europe begins to expand into other parts of the world. The voyages of so-called discovery, for example, of the Americas, which introduces a whole new set of languages to understand. The discoveries of the attempt to open up a route to the spice trade by sea into what they call the East Indies. That brings them into contact with Indian civilization, brings them into contact eventually with Chinese civilization. So they're discovering then a whole new set of texts, a whole new set of languages that they were mostly, not entirely, but mostly unfamiliar with during the Middle Ages. And that's a phenomenon really of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries.
Okay, so what happens, let's go back up a little bit. What happens in the Renaissance, which is this rediscovery of the ancients, right?
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
And then you've got the Reformation coming along.
Mm-hmm. That creates a whole new climate for philology, especially textual philology, but also the study of languages per se. A whole new climate for a couple of reasons. First of all, there are all these arguments about doctrine separating Protestants and Catholics, as they came to be known. And those arguments very often go back to the Bible. They also go back to the history of the ancient church, what's going on in the first centuries of Christianity, because Protestants and Catholics are claiming very different things about the proper structure and role of the church.
Now, the Bible at this point had, before the Reformation, had accumulated a lot of commentary, right, mm-hmm. in the sidelines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sorry, sidebars.
Right, exactly.
Which was loaded with doctrine mm-hmm. and speculation, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. which was one of the things that Luther meant when he said, you know, sola scriptura. He
yeah.
meant the Bible alone without all this exactly. commentary beside it.
Exactly, exactly.
And part of the struggle here during the Reformation was cleaning up the biblical text to what they thought would become to the pure, essential
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
text.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that happens then, and the Catholics cling to those early Latin translations known as the Vulgate, Protestants tend to go back to the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, as they call it. And so the study of Hebrew becomes more and more important. And one of the phenomena of the Reformation era is the emergence of what are called trilingual colleges, in which the key languages are Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And Harvard, for example, is founded as a collegium trilingue. In 17th century Harvard, students were taught Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And it's only in the 18th century that the study of Hebrew kind of falls away.
Well, did the Reformation situation, did this cause them to turn more to Jewish scholars? Even though there was a lot of animosity against
right.
Jewish people,
right.
but the Jewish scholars have been working on their Hebrew text for centuries.
They couldn't. The Christian scholars, by and large, a couple exceptions to this, couldn't stand Jews and couldn't do without them. They needed the rabbinic learning in order to understand their own Old Testament. So that's one thing that encourages the study of Hebrew. It also leads to more and more understanding among Christians, still very much laced with venom, but more and more understanding of Judaism, its rituals, its beliefs, and its ancient history. It's in the study of those early centuries of Christianity that Christian scholars first come to realize that in ancient Judaism, there was probably the majority of ancient Jews couldn't read or understand Hebrew. They were Greek speakers in the Eastern Mediterranean world. Their Bible was the Greek translation that early Christians had picked up on. And so there's this whole new understanding of the history of ancient Judaism. And literally, people just had forgotten, so to speak. They did not know that there was this ancient Greek Jewish culture from which Christianity took much of its shape.
Now, what was the problem that scholastic scholars had with philology?
They thought it was much less important than universal truths that could be achieved through philosophy and through logical deduction. So they see a pretty strong opposition between the process of logical reasoning from what they would have thought of as unquestioned premises to certain universal truths versus the kind of sloppy, empirical, imperfect philological study of ancient texts.
Or even going to historically.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Where does Erasmus fit in this?
He fits in very complicated ways. He was the most influential early scholar of the Greek New Testament. Now, remember, the church had used the Latin Vulgate, had favored the Latin Vulgate over the original Greek and Hebrew versions of the New Testament and Old Testament. Erasmus said, if you want to understand the New Testament, if you want to get it right, you have to go back to the Greek originals. And so he produced, this is a complicated story, he produced the first published Greek New Testament in the early modern world. Not the first printed version, because at the same time he was working, and working by our standards pretty sloppily, there was a group of scholars in Spain who were also working to produce a multilingual or polyglot Bible. And they had actually produced an edition of the Greek New Testament before Erasmus did. It was printed, but it couldn't be published without the Pope's approval. And that came a little bit later.
Now, Erasmus was loyal to the Catholic Church.
Yes.
He was always antagonistic, or Luther and him were always kind of dueling.
That's right.
intellectual.
Exactly. Though Erasmus was, like Luther, a reformer.
Right, but he stayed within the church.
He did.
And so the church, the Catholic Church, saw his work as sort of aiding the Protestants.
Yeah, they did.
Because he's trying to go back to some pure original version of the New Testament without all the explanations and doctrinal sidelines.
And he's undercutting the church's preference for the Latin Bible. And the Council of Trent, when the church tries to sort of figure out what it's going to do in response to the Protestant challenge, the church reaffirms the authority and primacy of the Vulgate, of the Latin version. So Erasmus is caught, as it were, between the two camps.
Let's get back to our topic, philology. At this point, humanistic scholarship, is there a notion of a unity of knowledge?
Yes, there is.
That somehow all these contradictions and things that don't seem to add up, if we just keep working on it, we're going to figure it out. It's all going to be one thing that's going to make sense.
Yes. Yeah. In a sense, you can see their attitude as like the attitude of a lot of modern natural scientists. That is to say, we don't understand dark energy at all. We have a very limited understanding of dark matter. But scientists are fairly confident that eventually all of this will hang together in a single coherent view of the world. And maybe lie far in the future. But that's how they think of this. Except that it's not just the natural world that they're...
It's human, human history.
Human history, human culture.
And language. Mm-hmm. That all... I noted the language trees that they were constructing with... showing where all the languages came from and how they brand. It was kind of an organic view of language.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Now we get into the first early, there's so much there. We could talk about that all day, but I want to get into the 19th century so we can get to the modern day. What did philology mean in the early 19th century?
Well, it meant... of course, textual philology, which is mostly what we've been talking about, the study of text. It meant the study of languages and language families. And by the beginning of the 19th century, the range of languages under serious study has enormously expanded as a result of European expansion into the rest of the world. You've got American Indian languages. You've got Sanskrit. You've got the serious study of, for example, the Germanic family of languages. It's part of the Indo-European family. So you've got a worldwide set of languages to study, and trying to understand the connections among them and trying to understand where connections don't exist, trying to understand the different structures. So that's also a very important part of 19th century philology. So you've got the study of texts, study of languages, and then you've got, in the 18th century especially, a lot of speculation about the origin of language, about the sort of fundamental nature of language, by people who remain very famous, like Adam Smith and Rousseau. And in the 19th century, that begins to develop into what we would now call theoretical linguistics. And so you've got all three of those aspects of the study of languages and texts: textual philology, study of languages and language families, the study of the phenomena of language itself.
So you've got this early 19th century philology is still pretty much intact. It has some different aspects, but humanistic scholars all see themselves as sort of working within this broader umbrella.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And they're crossing, going across.
Yes. And by the early 19th century, some people devote themselves pretty much to only one aspect of this large universe of philological knowledge. Other people are still going back and forth among different things.
Okay, now we're talking here about, we're not to disciplines yet. We don't have disciplines. We have humanistic scholars working with the tools of philology in a variety of different ways, and they're applying it to not just text, they're applying it to people group, art, structures, all kinds of things. Anything that can be read, quote unquote.
And it's important also to understand that the phenomenon of the study of the material relics of the past had always formed a part of a larger philological enterprise. During the early modern period, that came under the label of antiquarianism, which in a sense gave birth to modern archaeology and art history. And so that's part of the philological universe, even though the study of material relics is not, strictly speaking, philology. It's not a study of languages or texts. But the same people were often engaged in both enterprises. And so antiquarians tend to apply to the study of ancient relics like coins or buildings, or what have you, tend to apply the same cast of mind that textual philologists are using.
Now, at this point, is there an explosion in knowledge and number of texts?
There's certainly an explosion in the number of texts, but even more in the number of languages that Europeans know about. I think it's probably incorrect, however, to say that somehow the emergence of modern disciplines, that is to say, the splitting up of humanistic scholarship into unconnected areas of study, I think it's wrong to say that was inevitable. And I say that because even if you go back in the early modern period, people are dealing with vast quantities of information.
And also, they don't have the technologies we have now. You know, they didn't have computers. Everything was being, or typewriters, everything was being done manually.
That's right.
Which, when you describe some of the projects that some of your scholars in your book are doing, I'm thinking, how do they do that? Because we do a lot of stuff with our computers now that I can't imagine that people were doing manually.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
and one of the consequences of this is that a really good memory helped a lot. So that a philologist studying, say, ancient Roman text, if that person could remember, you know, everything that he had read in other Roman texts, he could bring that to bear on the particular text he was trying to study. And one of the characteristics of the great philologists of the 17th, 18th, and earlier 19th century is that they had phenomenal memories.
Right.
And I would have been a disaster.
And also, to some of these scholars, so to be a scholar of any weight, you had to have a lot of time.
You did.
And so most of these people were, what, elites? Most of these people are people who weren't earning a living doing this. This was almost like an amateur at a very high level.
Right. I mean, the distinction between amateur and professional.
Right.
In human society, it really doesn't make any sense in the early modern.
Right. These are monks and these are wealthy people. Who are these people?
Most of them by the 17th and 18th century are clerics of some kind or another. No longer monks.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Some are monks, but not most of them. They often increasingly have some kind of a connection to a university. If you look at, British philologists, for example, in the 18th and 19th centuries, they're almost all either fellows of the one of the colleges, or they are clerics who have a country parish, and they have lots of time on their hands. Particularly if they choose to devote themselves to learning rather than to their parishioners, and so that's where scholarship comes from.
Okay, so
that's one reason why there are almost no female philologists prior to the late 19th century.
Somebody's got to keep the world going. So you've got these. At this point, I noticed in the book that you were talking about that there was that the people who were doing the teaching in the universities were different from the people who were doing research.
Well, overlap.
There's overlap, but there were a lot of people doing research and writing. They were not
connected with a college or university.
Or who were also not teaching in the college or university. Mm-hmm. They were fellows or research fellows.
Right.
Okay. So how did this fragmentation of philology into all these different modern disciplines happen? And I know I'm asking a big question because you spend several chapters working on that. You've got literature, anthropology, religion, history, art history. Specifically, I would like for you to concentrate more on history because that's my particular interest. Okay. But tell us a story.
It's a complicated story to which two-thirds of the book is devoted. It's a story which I now think I understand pretty well empirically as what actually happened. I'm still sometimes puzzling about why it happened. And I hope eventually to write a book on the emergence of the modern idea of disciplinarity, as a way of seeing why this happened. Because there's an interaction between really two phenomena. One phenomena is the, increasing tendency of scholars, not all scholars, but most scholars, to focus on one aspect of humanistic learning. So that, for example, George Tickner at Harvard, who is the founder of the study of Spanish literary history, he has kind of broad interests. But his scholarship really focused relentlessly on Spanish literature and its history. And so that's one thing that's going on. And I think that does have something to do with the vast range that humanistic scholarship now covers. The other thing going on is the emergence of this idea of a discipline and the idea that, properly speaking, scholarly expertise should concentrate on one area of study. That is harder for me to understand the origin of. I think it has something to do with processes outside the world of scholarship, like professionalization. The division of labor in many areas of life. But whatever the origins of the idea of disciplinarity, it's there. And that is a very powerful influence on why this process of, well, division of labor within humanistic scholarship really becomes more rigid, turns into modern disciplines.
Now, all these disciplines, the modern disciplines that we think about that are humanistic, have things in common at the root, which all come from philology.
They are, if you leave aside philosophy, as you know, it's one of the humanistic disciplines in the modern American universities, at least. The British say they often do things differently and house philosophy outside of the humanities. But aside from philosophy, all of the modern humanistic disciplines, and a few that we don't think of as part of the humanities, but rather as part of the social sciences, and here I'm thinking primarily of cultural and social anthropology, they are all ultimately grounded in philology. It's not to say that there are not other influences on those disciplines. There certainly are. You know, certain aspects of philosophy, for example, play an important part in the emergence of literary criticism as opposed to literary history. Other aspects of philosophy, particularly the invention of aesthetics in the 18th century, play a shaping role in some aspects of art history. But all of the humanities and social and cultural anthropology have most of their foundations in philology and the closely associated antiquarianism that I talked about earlier. And so they tend usually to share a lot methodologically. They tend, for example, to put a fair amount of emphasis on understanding the history of a phenomenon as a way of understanding the nature of that phenomenon, why it has come to be the way it is. They tend to be comparative in nature. That's an important part of the toolkit of most of the modern humanities disciplines. And that, too, comes from philology. And they tend to be often, not always, but often very interested in context, in how the object of study, whether that's a novel or a historical development or anthropological study, how the object of study fits into some larger context that helps to make it more understandable and give meaning. And those are all things that come from philology.
So let's talk about history.
Okay.
Before we had a history that was based in the text, and philology had a huge emphasis on text and sources, documentary evidence. There was this philosophical history. Can you talk about philosophical history a little bit and how it went into the text in context?
Sure. Philosophical history is a phenomenon really of the 18th century, of the Enlightenment. I'm putting air quotes around the word Enlightenment because it's a complicated word. Voltaire is probably its best known practitioner. And it really is a sort of history teaching by example. The authors of philosophical histories are much less interested in the reliability of their sources than they are in a good narrative that has moral implications for the present world.
Let me ask you about that. Is there a place today, and I'm going forward because we're at this point, is philosophical history still a possibility?
I think it is. I don't think we would necessarily recognize it as history.
Right. It would be something else.
What,
cultural criticism?
Something like that.
Okay. Let's go back to what you were talking about. Philosophical history with Voltaire and how just teaching by example.
Yeah. So you get, in philosophical history, you get a much stronger emphasis on narrative than in forms of study in the past. In, say, medieval chronicles, for example. There really isn't narrative in our sense. And that gives, there certainly is narrative in ancient Roman history or in ancient Greek histories, in Thucydides or Tacitus, say. But that kind of falls away from the study of the past and is recovered by philosophical historians in the 18th century. And that is a very important component of history as we now understand it. Even when we write monographs that say are not chronological in nature and don't have what we would recognize as a storytelling narrative as at their heart, we think of them as kind of contributing to a larger overall story of the past and a narrative. So that's one important component of academic history as the discipline we understand. But the other important component of academic history is a very strong stress on documentary sources, on texts that are analyzed for their reliability and then used to produce the facts. And again, I'm using air quotes here for listeners, that go to make up a historical narrative. That is a very complicated story, how we got that. You see it developing in the later 18th century, most strikingly in Gibbon, in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon is very attracted to the philosophical narrative of someone like Voltaire, but is, unlike Voltaire, very interested in the philological underpinnings of the information on which that narrative is built. So he's very committed to, he's not himself a philologist, but he relies very heavily on philologists for his source material. And so you had in Gibbon really the first great example of someone that we would recognize as a historian, quote unquote, in the modern academic sense. That doesn't mean to say that it's just all a smooth development from there to the modern historian. There's lots of modes of doing history in the early 19th century. And the textual documentary-based history really only triumphs towards the middle and later 19th century.
Which brings up the issue of archives, mm-hmm. which you don't really talk about very much in your book, but this, mm-hmm. there's probably a whole history of it could be written on just mm-hmm. archives and mm-hmm. Compiling archives mm-hmm. and what's in the archives mm-hmm. and how reliable archives are and what they bring in and what mm-hmm. they keep out. Mm-hmm. And historians are depending on archivists and mm-hmm. what they collected mm-hmm. to build their story.
Right.
Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I do talk a little bit about archives. And they are, the archives originate, really, as a way of keeping records for practical purposes. Monasteries keep records of their charters and their foundational documents and the grants that are made to them by kings. Late medieval and early modern monarchies start to keep records of that sort as a way of basically providing a legal foundation for what they want to do. So you've got those archives emerging as ways of keeping track of your property and your powers. And then in the late 18th and early 19th century, the understanding of an archive, and these are still principally archives maintained by governments, but the understanding of an archive broadens. It becomes to be thought of as a potential source, not just for legitimizing the government's activities, but a potential source for historical understanding. One of the things that happens in the wake of the American Revolution is that in various states, mostly in the Northeast, groups of people come together to try to preserve the records of the revolution so that later generations can understand that story accurately. So you get these various projects in the early 19th century to protect and preserve and improve archives. Again, they're still mostly archives of political developments, but they are understood now as places where historians are going to go to be able to tell their stories.
Okay. So I'm going to spend a little time on where we are today. Have we lost touch with the importance of language? Do you think that we think that politics or psychology is more important than language? Is there a loss of focus on language?
Well, I think there is. Not, of course, among linguists.
Right. No, but among...
But among the general educated public, I think there is. In the 19th century, almost any well-educated person would have understood the language and the study of language as an important part of the intellectual heritage.
And that's what I noted about the educational process, particularly in the 19th century, how much language was required for undergraduate students in terms of, you know, like you said, Greek, Hebrew, Latin. Mm-hmm. And you, before you could do history, before you did anything else, you had to really be able to deal and handle different languages mm-hmm. well. And we don't have that rigor.
We don't. Now, it also has to be said that by the 19th century, that the enormous amount of Latin, particularly, that was required in education was a dinosaur. You know, Latin had, in earlier centuries, a very practical purpose. That is to say, it was the language not just of learning, but the language of government, the language of international relations. And so learning Latin was a first step to being not just a cleric, but to being a government bureaucrat, say, a diplomat in the early modern period. And it hangs on because it's a badge, I think, because it's a badge of elite learning.
Okay.
It separates the learner.
But would you say that today we could probably, if we're studying the 19th century, 18th, 19th century, how do we do that without having a deep understanding of German mm-hmm. and French?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I quite agree. I mean, one of the things that has happened in my lifetime as an historian is that the study of language for historians, as part of your preparation to be an historian, has really been marginalized. You still, of course, a German historian still knows German well, a French historian still knows French well, et cetera, et cetera. But American historians and historians of Britain often don't know any foreign language.
Right. And I think doesn't that constrain the kinds of histories we're going to write? It's very difficult to engage in transnational histories mm-hmm. In understanding that the America within a broader mm-hmm. world if we don't have other languages besides English.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I could not have written this book if I had not been forced in graduate. I never studied a modern language in my higher education or my high school. I had 4 years of Latin in high school, which was required at my Jesuit high school in Dallas. And I had a semester of Latin in college, never a modern language. I learned French and German because they were the languages that really an intellectual historian was understood to need when I was in graduate school in the early 1970s. I learned Spanish because you had to pass two language exams in your first year of graduate study. You couldn't go on to your second year. And I was teaching high school at the time I was in my first year of graduate school. I taught myself French to read French the summer before I started grad school. I knew I needed German. I knew I wasn't going to be able to learn it in my first year. So I, having Latin and French, I was able to cram enough Spanish to pass the Spanish exam. So, and then I took German as a summer program the next summer. And so by then I had three modern languages. And later when I started to work on Norton, who was among other things, a great Dante scholar, I knew I needed Italian. And so I took Italian at the University of Michigan, where I was then teaching with all the freshmen. And so, you know, and I picked up a little bit of Dutch, and my Latin is still not great, but workable. So without those languages, I really couldn't have written this book.
So I think it sounds like we're really constraining our possibilities by stepping away from language requirements.
I think so.
Now, you're the professor emeritus. And so, and you know the crisis that's going on in the humanities.
I know the dialogue about the discourse.
Okay. How do you see that?
I see it as a little more complicated than a lot of the prophets of doom, if you will.
Okay.
It is true that enrollments in the humanities at elite universities like Harvard and Stanford have tended to decline, and sometimes decline very dramatically in recent years. I know that in a lot of state universities, the humanities are under financial pressure because you have politicians like the governor of Florida who think that it's kind of a waste of time to spend state money on something that doesn't have an immediate economic use. So there are elements of this story which talk about crisis, but probably given the expansion of higher education, there are probably a larger number of people taking courses in some area of the humanities than was true in the first half of the 20th century, which we sometimes think of as the glory days of the humanities. So I think it's a complex story. And part of the expansion of higher education has brought into higher education people whose purpose for going to a community college or a state college or even an elite private university, their purpose is really primarily to better themselves economically, to prepare themselves for the job market. And so you have all of those Stanford students who are not enrolling in the humanities, not majoring in the humanities at least. What are they doing? They're doing computer sciences. So there is a...
But do you feel like...
The humanities are under pressure. They're undergoing change. I don't know that there's a crisis.
Okay. Do you feel that an educated person today has a college degree, should have a strong foundation in the humanities, and that's weakening.
I do think that's true. I think that having a grounding in history and literature and anthropology in particular give you a broader understanding of your fellow human beings. And they also may give you certain skills, writing and analysis and so forth, that may feed into, may improve your work in other areas. I do think all that's true. I also think it's true that it has never been the case that the majority of our fellow citizens have had that kind of background, or even had the opportunity to have that kind of background.
Now, I started the interview talking to you about the disciplinary straitjacket. Mm-hmm. Which I think you feel that probably needs a little bit more openness across disciplines.
Yes. One of the things that has struck me in studying the emergence of the modern humanities is that humanists actually often tend to be less flexible and sometimes less open to cross-disciplinary work than natural scientists do. Particularly in physics and biology, or the biological sciences. So I think that if humanists were to recognize how much they have in common in the emergence of their areas of study, I think they might become less narrow. They might be more open to cross-disciplinary work. They might... even return to broader conceptions of what their disciplines mean.
And it seems to me like intellectual historians are really kind of poised to do that, because we can use all kinds of texts, not just documentary evidence. Mm-hmm. We can look at poetry, and we can look at novels, and we can look at a multitude of different things, even material culture, I think, and popular culture to construct our narratives. So what do you think, what do you feel about...
Most of what you've mentioned, with the exception of material objects, takes the form of texts. As even in studying popular culture, intellectual historians, at least, tend to do it not so much by watching movies as by studying textual remains of popular culture.
Okay. So what do you feel that your book is, what do you think that people should take away from your book? What is the main thing you want people to get from reading this book? It's a very erudite book, like the people that you cover. It's full of challenges. I think it may, I felt really small reading it. meaning in comparison to the people who, have come before us and their amazing grasp of so many fields of knowledge and jumping from one field of knowledge to another without computers, without all the modern, you know, gadgets that we have to keep us abreast of what's going on, and their language, their focus on language, their really grasp of the meaning and importance of language. I just felt like, wow. I'm not sure I could ever meet that standard.
I feel like a midget too when I contemplate the people before us. Michael O'Brien, the great intellectual historian at Cambridge, who unfortunately died of cancer this spring, much too young, told me that he used to keep, when he was a graduate student, I guess, used to keep a portrait of Erasmus on his wall in the room his study, I guess, just to remind him what this was all about. and it is a kind of daunting story. It also, I think, can be an inspiring story. I mean, these are if we feel like midgets compared to these people, well, maybe that feeling might inspire us to try to grow a little bit, to stand on the shoulders of giants, and as Newton, among others, said. And I think that this story may also remind scholars that in the humanities that their field is not as narrow as they might have been taught to think it is in graduate school. That it is that historians and literary scholars and so forth have much more in common than what separates them, and they ought to be able to work together more closely. And they shouldn't be afraid. A literary scholar should not be afraid of writing history. The historian should not be afraid of writing about literature. That these are things which are perfectly legitimate because they are bred into our genetic heritage, so to speak, as humanists. I think general readers, particularly those who have gone to college, might take away from this story an understanding of how their studies and their current reading interconnect, of how all of this hangs together. When I was still teaching, and my bread and butter was a survey course of American intellectual history, at the end of the semester, particularly when I was teaching the second half of American intellectual history, it was a very common experience for students to come to me who were majors in, you know, literature or sociology or whatever, and say, you know, I now understand for the first time where my major fits in the larger world of knowledge. And I think that that's something that maybe a lot of people, readers of this book, might learn from this book.
I definitely think this book could be used for an introduction to the humanities.
It's being used, as I discovered.
Okay, it's excellent for introduction to humanities. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Jim. I appreciate your time. You've been very generous.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.